The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. Hi, my name is Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
And we are here today to talk about privacy. Our guest today is Mark Rotenberg. He is President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. We're very pleased to have Mark. Mark, would you please go ahead and introduce yourself?
I'm the director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center in Washington, D.C. We focus on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues, and we're particularly interested in the legal and policy consequences of new technologies. Just a little bit about my background. Before I started EPIC, I was in Washington, D.C., working as a lawyer for the United States Senate on a newly created committee concerning technology and law. This was back in the 1980s, and at that time, we were dealing with a lot of interesting issues concerning privacy, computer security, open government, and it gave me the opportunity in the early days to begin to think about how the law might respond to some of these new developments. I went on a few years later to establish EPIC. We've worked on a lot of interesting issues over the years with a lot of interesting people, and I look forward to our conversation talking about the consequences of technology.
Excellent. Mark, it's really nice to have you with Leslie and I. I guess the first question would be, does privacy exist anymore? Is there such a thing as online privacy, or is it already gone?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it's almost biblical in its significance, going back to Adam and Eve, in fact. You can say that we lost privacy from the start. But in fact, I think each generation in its own way rediscovers the importance of privacy. And then there is an ongoing discussion about how to safeguard privacy and what the boundaries should be. I know with my own kids, some things that they do seem to me much more open in sharing personal information. But then there are other things that they care about in their new media world that I had never thought about, where they make strong claims of privacy. So I actually think it is very much related in the world in which people exist. Even prisoners, you know, have a sense of privacy, and they're under constant observation. So it's really fascinating. Yes, to come back to your question, I think we do have privacy, but obviously it's under attack.
So what are some of the things that are important to safeguard? If we can't say that there's sort of an absolute definition of privacy, then what are the sort of the things to focus on in terms of saying how to do things right or less right?
Well, when you move from what the problem is to what the solutions are, you cover a lot of ground. I actually put together a book a few years ago because I've been fascinated by that challenge. I think we've done a very good job over the years describing the many problems, and certainly George Orwell's 1984 gave us all an excellent frame of reference for how bad things might get. I've spent most of my career thinking about how to prevent Orwell's 1984. I didn't read the book as prediction. I read the book as challenge. So when you're thinking about solutions so that you avoid an outcome like 1984, I think you have to move beyond the, you know, the micro deleting cookies, making privacy preferences, reading privacy policies, which are typically not very effective. I think you need to move to the macro. I think you need to talk about the design of systems, the structure of law, the enforcement of privacy rights, where we collectively agree that there's a common interest in safeguarding privacy, and we're not left as, you know, autonomous individuals out there on our own, struggling against this new technology.
Mark, when we think about privacy a lot and some of the issues that you just raised, some of it perhaps we could track back to the business models of, you know, companies that have been under attack because of the way they actually handle our private data. And a lot of this is sort of a quid pro quo. In other words, they give us a little bit of entertainment or convenience and we give up privacy. Is that your view as well? And do you think that that is going to change? Can we change that?
I think that's one of the key questions you just asked. I mean, there's no doubt that the business model today is having an enormous impact on privacy. Shoshana Zuboff wrote this book called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism and basically argued that the information economy is driven by the collection and use of personal data. And I think that's true. At the same time, I don't think it's fair to us to say that we have engaged in a trade-off and a quid pro quo where we have meaningfully given up our privacy in return for some service, like, let's say, free email or free search. Oftentimes in those situations, we really don't have a choice. I mean, if you want to use search, you have to reveal certain information. And even if you were to go in and read the privacy policy where the company says what they will and what will not do with your data, invariably the companies over time will dial down their privacy settings. So you sign up for a service, you say, okay, I understand what I'm getting myself into. And then 6 months later, the business model has evolved and suddenly you find data that you thought was private now made public. And that in fact is the history of Facebook. Because if you track their privacy settings from the early days, which are actually pretty good, and then see how they evolved over time, what you will find for almost every single setting is that Facebook purposely chose to make the user data more widely available. And from Facebook's perspective, it was rational because they had business opportunities that they didn't know about at the outset. And they said, well, if we can make that data available, that's, you know, good for us. But it was entirely unfair, at least in my view, to the users, because that's not what they had signed up for. So yes, it's very much about business models. I think that's clear. But I don't think it's true that we, in fact, trade our privacy for these services. I think our data is taken from us, oftentimes in ways that we don't understand and haven't actually agreed to.
And to what extent is the latter made worse by, I don't want to say big data, but the extent to which, you know, you might have a little bit of data taken from you by one service, put together with another little bit of data from another service, and a broader picture gets made of your activities than could be inferred just by one service. So sort of the little bits of data leaking, combining into bigger impacts.
Yes, well, that's actually key to the modern advertising model.
Right.
And it's also the reason why it doesn't make much sense to talk about what information people choose to disclose, let's say, to Google and Facebook, because both of those companies are aggregating data about their users from multiple data sources over which the user has no control. So to imagine that somehow you have freely chosen to give your personal data to a company that has, let's say, 5,000 data points on you, and is also tracking you, by the way, on the service in ways that you don't understand. That's really a bit of a myth. But at the same time, you know, I really do believe in solutions. One of the things we've tried to do over the years at Epic is, you know, not complain so much, but when we find a problem, talk about how to fix it. And I'm very interested in techniques of data minimization. I've talked for many years about privacy enhancing techniques. I know that phrase is widely used in the technical community. I have a very specific meaning in the policy world. And when I say a privacy enhancing technique, I mean a technique that minimizes or eliminates the collection of personally identifiable information. So if you can develop a payment system or a communication system or whatever the service may be that doesn't require you to collect a lot of user data, I think that's great. And I actually think that's where a lot of innovation should occur, because I'd like to see more services, but I'd also like to see more services that don't require collecting so much personal data.
Mark, can you just go into what is personally identifiable information in the terms of privacy? And then I guess, you know, if you were to make a counter argument, are there cases where giving up a little privacy actually provides some dividends? For example, if you think about when London initially put all these cameras, right, there was a big brouhaha over people objecting to having, you know, every part of their existence being effectively filmed when they're outside. But on the other hand, it really helps the, you know, London City, for example, in identifying potential malfeasance or identifying, you know, when a potential terrorist attack could occur. So are there cases where giving up a little privacy could actually be better for the for society in general?
Right. So that's a great question. And certainly we have relations of trust where we disclose personal information to others. You know, maybe it's to a doctor, for example. We want the doctor to have a complete picture of our medical condition to provide an accurate diagnosis. Maybe it's to a business partner because we want to have a fair understanding of the circumstances of our company. There are lots and lots of ways in which, you know, people certainly reveal personal data to others and actually in the act build bonds of trust, which are important. I have a concern, however, about systems of, let's say, mass surveillance when governments collect data from people largely for the purpose of control or coercion. London is an interesting example. You know, I think the data is really not conclusive as to whether it has minimized, let's say, criminal conduct. In the United States, there was a very extensive surveillance program put in place under the Patriot Act. It's called Section 215, and it gave the NSA access to all the call detail records of American telephone subscribers. And the theory was that if we had access to all that telephone record information, we'd be able to identify and prevent future terrorist acts. And, you know, I remember 9/11, I remember the response afterward, and preventing future terrorist acts is probably one of the top priorities today for the intelligence community. And I respect that. But the interesting point here is that when there was an extensive investigation of Section 215 in the Patriot Act, and the FBI and the intelligence community was given every opportunity to explain the value of that program, Congress ultimately concluded it wasn't effective. It hadn't prevented any terrorist acts, and I think wisely decided to pull back. So in this space, when we're talking about government claims to collect a lot of data and conduct surveillance, I do take the concern seriously. We don't, you know, dismiss what the other side is saying. But I also think they have a responsibility to really make their case, to prove that they actually need the data. Because invariably, the other thing that happens is that the original reason for gathering the data doesn't pan out, but someone comes along and says, oh, I've just uncovered this other use. And now you're into the world of mission creep. And government agencies are really good at that. You know, it justifies continued funding and program activity, but oftentimes it's almost entirely unrelated to where something started.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can get if you can go on a fishing expedition, right? I mean, when you're not preventing an attack with the data, but perhaps you want to have the data to go through afterwards to see if you can find patterns and clues or things. But I wanted to go back to 1984 because it occurs to me that we're sort of at an interesting point where 9/11 is approximately halfway back between now and 1984, the actual year. So 9/11 really is the event that could have kicked off and to a certain extent did kick off a lot of government programs that could be very 1984-ish. And so far haven't. So far you've been successful in your professional battle to prevent 1984 from becoming a reality. But I wondered if you could reflect a little bit on how the technology itself has changed sort of in that sweep of time. You know, the kinds of technologies that you were looking at and concerned about were privacy in the 80s would be very different than now, and how have things changed?
Right. Also a great question. Let me say, by the way, I don't feel that we actually ever win. Maybe we win a battle, but to be certain, it is an ongoing war. And to me, you know, privacy protection has often felt like environmental protection, in the sense that, you know, the information economy is so key to our world, just like the industrial economy. You don't ever actually solve the problem. The best you can do is to try to manage it, and, you know, address some of the biggest challenges. So that's what we've tried to do. I thought we had made a lot of success after 9/11. I remember debating the Total Information Awareness Program, and the government appeared to back off of that. And then, of course, we had the Snowden revelations just a few years ago and realized that the scope of government surveillance was much greater than we knew. So even where we thought we might have had a success, when we looked a little bit more closely, we realized that there were actually problems that we had not recognized. I will say today, my focus, fascination, and worry, which is a word I try to avoid, but I'm just going to put it out there, really is around AI. I've worked with a lot of experts over the years who are very thoughtful about this, really trying to understand, for example, how decisions are made about consumers seeking loans, or about job applicants, or about people going for government grants or clearances. And, you know, there's no question that there's a lot more data that's being gathered. The analytic process has become more opaque. There's a lot more predictive modeling based not necessarily on what a particular person has done in the past, but what people like that person has done in the past, to then make a judgment, for example, in the criminal sentencing world, whether to give someone a 6-month sentence or a 2-year sentence. So it is moving rapidly through our lives. Some people have said, even to use the term AI is a bit misleading, because we've used a lot of similar techniques over the years in the past. Although my little, you know, background in AI suggests that there is a sharp difference between, let's say, a rule-based expert system that you can examine, interrogate, and correct, and a machine learning system that produces outcomes you're not actually quite sure how they came about. So to me, that looks like a big difference. And I do see real challenges. I mean, I'm fascinated. I play a lot of tournament chess. So I'm fascinated, for example, by what AlphaZero did to the chess world, really got everyone rethinking what computers and chess would be about, but even what the best move in a particular position was, because AlphaZero beat the reigning computer champion. And at the same time, I worry increasingly because of hiring decisions made by a company like HireVue, which says we can extract useful information from a person's facial expressions and tell the employer whether or not that's the right person to hire. How do you know that? How do you prove that? You know, what if the person just wasn't feeling well that day? I think there's a really interesting and difficult question that we need to pursue.
So I want to drill down a little bit on that, because I mean, you started describing sort of a, to use more movie references or literature, popular references, a Minority Report situation, right? Where,
exactly.
It, you know, you get predictive, predict other people's behavior based on data analysis of large populations. But the key thing in what you described was the unverifiability, the unexaminability of these choices, right? You don't know, first of all, you don't know that these choices are being made often, to the point about we were completely unaware about the extent to which data was being collected until the Snowden revelations. And then second of all, even if you do know that data is being collected and choices are being made, there's no way to defend yourself if you can't argue against the decision that was made. So where do we go with with those sorts of choices?
Right. Well, that's a big part of the focus of the work these days at Epic, because we do see increasing complexity and increasing opacity around automated decision making. And the questions we ask are how do we ensure fairness? How do we ensure accountability? And how do we ensure transparency? And for people who are designing the systems, those are actually difficult questions, you know, and they may say to us, well, you know, ideally that would be nice stuff to do, but we can't actually, you know, produce that and go ahead with the system as we're planning. And our response is, well, maybe you don't go ahead with the system that you're planning. Maybe your obligation is to figure out how you're going to meet those objectives, and then you go ahead with the system. And that's actually when things get very interesting. You know, you asked me early on about a conception of privacy. I have been in a lot of discussions with a lot of technologists with great ambitions who know a bit about privacy, and invariably they will say something like, we need to begin to rethink our conception of privacy. And what they're saying in effect is, I'm about to design a system that's not going to allow you to protect certain kinds of personal information you've been able to protect. So you actually need to rethink how much privacy you're going to get. And I always push back in those situations. I mean, I don't have any problem with innovation, but this determinist view from some that says, in effect, you know, what I'm about to do needs to happen. And if there are policy obstacles in the way, we need to remove those. That's precisely the battle that we're quite happy to have.
Right.
My view is that if you can't design systems that safeguard fundamental rights, you know, find another line of work. You know, Starbucks is still hiring.
So, Mark, going back to sort of AI algorithms, it seems to me that one of the things that when you were talking about is how do you safeguard or at least have transparency when these algorithms are created so that the bias isn't sort of baked in. For example, if there's a group of folks who are working for HireVue, programmers, and all of them are white males, there is an inherent bias that could actually be baked into the algorithm that says if you're hiring for technical jobs, developers just like their own, they tend to, algorithm would say, you know, it is going to be folks that just look like them. So does that mean that the sort of definition of privacy and the remit of the thing, of the work that Epic is doing, is going to go into looking at the ethics of what is actually being programmed into these algorithms and also the sample data that they collect from to train these machines? Is that a good way of characterizing it?
It is most certainly one of our policy goals. We've spent a lot of time over the last few years helping to draft international policy frameworks. We've worked with the OECD and the European Commission and the White House to talk about what the policy objectives should be for AI. We have a human rights framework, which we call the Universal Guidelines for AI, and transparency appears in just about all of these documents. Now, there is, of course, a bit of a tension around that term, and some people who develop these systems will say, well, you don't mean transparency literally, because, of course, you know, it would be almost meaningless to you or to anyone who's subject to one of these decisions. You probably want something like explainability. And so they're quite happy to shift over to a discussion that says, well, we're going to explain to people how we produced a result. But I don't actually find that satisfying because to me, that doesn't give people the ability to prove a result or to determine whether the result was accurate or could be replicated. When someone says they want to explain a result, it sounds a bit more like a justification for why what they produce they think is correct. And that's actually the proposition that I think we need the ability to contest. And my hope, you know, this is not just coming from a lawyer's perspective about fairness, but I think it's also deeply felt in the scientific community. But you actually
in the what community? Sorry.
In the scientific community. Oh. I mean, in the computer science community. I mean, people actually do want to know how results are produced, mm-hmm. Particularly results that impact them at a personal level. If it were a machine that decided whether you got a promotion or whether you got a loan or whether you got an award, you might be satisfied if the decision was fair. But if you had reason to believe, for example, that relevant information was not included, that outdated information was part of the decision, or that maybe it was a record concerning someone else and not even you, right, that produced the outcome, you know, you'd be rightly upset. And people say to me, well, that's kind of hypothetical, isn't it? And I said, no, actually, that's the history of the credit reporting industry. And the reason we passed privacy laws 50 years ago to ensure accuracy and transparency with credit reports, because that was exactly the experience that people had with the first wave of automation of personal data.
So Alexa referred to the concern of, you know, if you're training or building systems, you'll build systems based on, you know, people who are sitting around the table with you. And it comes back to a question of maybe where the transparency needs to be is in the data set. You know, what data are you using to train these systems? And if you are indeed saying training your job hiring AI based on white male engineers, then there's a lot of us that will never fit the bill, no matter what, no matter how many times you run.
Well, I mean, I think it's great that over the last few years there's been more public attention to that particular issue, and I think it's an issue that does need to be addressed. I think the problem is even more embedded than the description you're suggesting. It's not simply the fact that you may have a lot of white guy engineers, you know, deciding what are relevant qualifications for success. Let's say you hire an employment screening firm to find employees who are going to succeed at a particular firm. And the employment screening firm looks at the firm and goes, oh, well, we see what kind of people succeed at the firm. They're like, you know, white guys, elite schools, all these characteristics. And if that company is doing their job, regardless of who the engineers are, this is where it gets interesting. They will simply replicate the characteristics of the people already at the firm, right?
Right.
And so what you're doing is taking bias that's out there, routinizing it, and replicating it through an automated system. And those are the kinds of challenges that I think are particularly important for us to think about. One of the obvious areas where this is a real concern is in the criminal justice system, you know, because the criminal justice system is heavily skewed in terms of the type of people, first of all, that are arrested, and secondly, that are brought to trial and convicted and then incarcerated. And at each stage of the criminal justice system, you will see that. Now, if you have an individual before you as a judge, let's say, and you're trying to make a decision about that individual, and you draw on all this data that a big machine learning system has put together for you, it's obvious what the outcome will be, irrespective of the character of that person. And that's where I think some of the greatest concern arises, because we don't want to judge people that way. And we certainly don't want that to be built into our future decision making.
I think that it's particularly key, as you describe it, in the context of hiring, that to understand that this sort of AI or data learning is machine learning based on data is inherently retrospective, right? You can only look at past data and draw trends from that, and it doesn't allow much for future possibilities, no matter how you slice it.
Well, I'm glad you said it that way. I don't know that that's the way most people think about it. I think most people almost purposefully think that it's predictive.
In other words,
you're correct. It is data about past events.
Right.
But the reason that people are looking at those past events is because they're trying to make a judgment about a future.
Right. But it can only be a partial representation of the future, right? Because it's drawing only on the past. I mean, it allows no creativity, which is fundamentally what has driven
And it also, by the way, that people are deterministic. I mean, at least in the sense that if you have enough data about a particular type of person, you know, with some high degree of confidence, you can predict future action. Now, I've spoken with people recently in the AI field who believe that deeply. I mean, I was killed by it. But there are people who say, well, that's absolutely true. But to me, that just, you know, undermines all of our sense of what freedom and responsibility are about. Because if we really are just computational devices, then there's not much, you know, in the way of choice.
Yeah, and you can even take that down to a really personal level, right? I mean, if you look at my personal data over the course of the last 20 years, you know, there are very strong predictors that I'm going to go downstairs and get a chocolate chip cookie. But, you know, if I want to believe I have a prayer at ever being able to lose weight, I need to believe that that doesn't have to be the future, you know?
Or maybe that you'll reach for the yogurt this time.
There you go. Could happen.
Could happen.
So swinging over to a more positive note, would you say that there are technologies that have been developed that have a more positive consequences for privacy?
Well, I'm careful about endorsing products and services, but I will say that a lot of the folks that we've worked with over the years at Epic have done some really innovative stuff. I mean, one person who had a big impact on me was David Chaum. And what David did in the world of cryptography and privacy was to separate the concepts of authentication and identification. So basically to say, yes, if you're going to purchase alcohol in a liquor store, we need a credential that says you're over 18, but we actually don't need to know who you are. And in that simple step, I think launched a way of thinking about privacy that is just enormously useful. Because in fact, organizations do need certain types of information about people, but it is typically a credential. It's something that can provably show they have whatever the characteristic qualification is to do what the organization needs them to do. It is not, you know, the whole person's life, their social network, and everything they've ever done or thought about. And the problem oftentimes in the privacy world is we almost immediately find ourselves in that second category, trying to figure out how much personal data to parse out. I was really taken by David's model. I said, gee, I mean, let's try to, you know, do that approach to lots and lots of things. I happen to like hotel key cards. I have a collection. Hmm. You know, hotel key cards, really interesting. Because for you, it does exactly what it needs to do. It gets you into your room. For the hotel, it gives them control over your access. You know, once your reservation is up or if you fail to pay the bill, they turn it off. And to a third party, it's like entirely useless. You know, they'll pick up a card on the street that says Best Western and it has no meaning. So in that example, I've often thought, how do we replicate that in the digital world to protect privacy, to allow businesses to get the information they need, and to prevent the risk of third-party access? It's a, you know, it's a powerful metaphor.
Mark, are there things that the average user can do to help at least protect their own privacy, aside from, you know, being more educated, looking at settings on social media and whatnot? You know, are there practical things that they can do, or you know, certain technologies like maybe the Tor browser or something?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, and honestly, I don't think there's a good answer. I mean, I would say, you know, go for a hike with a friend and leave your cell phones. A lot of the settings and a lot of the privacy policies and a lot of the things that people try to do, in fact, are almost meaningless. Companies ignore them. Agencies that should enforce changes in privacy policies don't. And I think it's almost a bit unfair to expect people to take on the responsibility of trying to, you know, manage the complexity of an internet-based service. I said it's a little bit like telling a car owner that when you get up in the morning, before you put the key in the ignition and push the accelerator, it's on you to check the thickness of your brake line. And you should take out a pair of calipers, you know, check the standards, see if you've got at least 3 millimeters of rubber sitting on the rear rotor before you get in your car and turn on the ignition. And people say, well, that's a little silly. And I said, well, actually, any company that says you should check your privacy settings is asking you to take more time than it would take me to check the brake linings on my rear rotors. So this is really the point. I mean, in the consumer world, we typically assume that a product is safe to use as we would normally use it. We're not checking the insulation, for example, on the cord of a toaster before we plug it into the wall. We assume that that's been sorted out between the manufacturer and a safety agency. But oddly, in the internet world, you know, we expect someone to know, you know, whether Triple Des has been busted yet. I mean,
right. Unfair. Or read through all like pages and pages of legalese before clicking OK so they can get to the other step.
So as I said,
what you want to do then?
You know, what do you want? What do you do to protect your privacy? I'm like,
yeah,
oh, I go swimming. I mean, just I'm not going to waste time with privacy settings.
Well, it sounds like then, you know, some of the work that you guys are doing, consumers should not only be more aware, but really try to get behind some of the work that perhaps organizations like Epic are doing. So can you talk a little bit about Epic and how you get support?
Yeah. So we have a great website, and I'm very proud of the fact that we've been sitting out there on the internet in the .org domain pretty much from the start. So we're online at epic.org. We have a great collection of resources. We do have a page called Practical Privacy Tools for people who are interested in learning more about some of the techniques that people use to protect their privacy, but we can't really guarantee any of them because a lot of them, in fact, over time do change, which is a problem. We're right now working to promote privacy legislation in the United States. We'd like to see a federal baseline bill. That means that you leave in place stronger state laws, like the law in California, for example. We'd like to see a federal privacy agency. We think we need an agency now with a focus and expertise to work on privacy. And in the AI world, we've been promoting the Universal Guidelines for Artificial Intelligence. It's the first global framework for AI that focuses specifically on human rights issues. And plus we have a great bookstore. So even though we're online and digital, I'm still kind of an analog paper person. And we have the Epic bookstore where a lot of our publications and the publications of the folks we work with are available for sale. And yes, you can also download a lot in digital format if that's your preference.
Well, thank you very much. I think both Lizzie and I feel like we can have a much, much longer discussion. There's so many other threads we could go down on. But thank you for your time. Thank you for the work that you've put in to Epic and to protecting and raising issues and advocating for greater privacy. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. Nice speaking with you.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod, and you can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this podcast or ideas for future episodes. Be sure to catch all the episodes in this privacy and security arc, including conversations with Mark Rotenberg, Suzanne Wolf, and Eve Naylor. You can follow TechSequences on Twitter to hear about new episodes and topic arcs. Thanks for listening.